information chart. Slightly too low, but obviously not too low. Welcome to Borg, Britt Marie reads while she sits on a stool in the darkness and looks at the red dot that first made her fall in love with the picture. The reason for her love of maps. It's half worn away, the dot, and the red colour is bleached. Yet it's there, flung down there on the map, halfway between the lower left corner and its centre. And next to it is written, "You are here." Sometimes it's easier to go on living not even knowing who you are, when at least you know precisely where you are, while you go on not knowing. Chapter 15. People sometimes refer to darkness as something that falls, but in places like Borg it doesn't just fall, it collapses. It engulfs the streets in an instant. In cities there are so many people who don't want to sit at home all night that you can open dedicated premises and run entertainment industries that are open only at these times. But in Borg, life is encapsulated once darkness falls. Britt Marie locks the door of the recreation centre and stands on her own in the parking area. Her pockets are full of neatly folded toilet paper because she did not find an envelope. The sign above the pizzeria is turned off, but she can make out the shadow of somebody moving around inside. Something in Britt Marie wants to go and talk to her, possibly to buy something. Another considerably more rational something orders her to do no such thing. It's dark outside. It's not civilized to walk into shops when it's dark outside. She stands by the door, listening to the radio inside, which is playing some sort of pop music. Britt Marie knows this because she's not at all unfamiliar with pop music. There are many crossword questions about it, and Britt Marie likes to keep herself informed. But this particular song is new to her. A young man is singing in a cracked voice about how you can either be someone or no one at all. Britt Marie is still holding on to the carton of cigarettes covered in foreign letters. She doesn't know how much foreign cigarettes cost, but she gets out a considerably larger than reasonable amount of money from her handbag and folds it in the toilet paper until it looks like a small envelope with a phenomenal capacity for water absorption. Then she carefully tucks it under the door. The young man keeps singing on the radio, as hard as he can, about nothing much. "Love has no mercy," he sings, again and again. "Love has no mercy." Kent wells up in Britt Marie's chest until she can't breathe. Then she walks by herself along a road that heads out of a community in two directions, as darkness collapses. Towards a bed and a balcony that are not her own. The truck comes up on her right from behind, too close, too fast. That's why she throws herself across to the other side of the road. The human brain has a monstrous ability to recreate memories of such clarity that the rest of the body loses all sense of time. An approaching truck can make the ears believe they are hearing a mother screaming, can make the hands believe they are cutting themselves on glass, can make the lips taste blood. Deep inside, Britt Marie has time to yell Ingrid's name 1,000 times. The truck thunders by, so close that her heart can't tell whether it's been run over or not, in a rain of hard lumps of mud gouged out of the road surface. Britt Marie takes a few tottering steps. Her coat is wet and dirty. There's a howling in her ears. Maybe a single second passes, and maybe 100. She blinks at the headlights with a growing awareness that the howling is not coming from inside. There's actually a car sounding its horn. She hears someone yelling. She holds up her hand to shield her eyes from the headlights of the BMW. Friedrich, the man who came to the cafe earlier, is standing in front of her, shouting furiously.
"Are you bloody senile or what, you old bat? What are you doing, walking in the middle of the fucking road? I almost killed you."
The way he puts it, it's as if her death would have been an inconvenience to him more than anyone else. She doesn't know what to say. Her heart is racing so frantically that it's giving her a stitch. Friedrich throws out his arms.
"Can you hear what I'm saying, or are you a retard?"
He takes two steps towards her. She doesn't know why. Looking back on it, she's unsure whether he was intending to hit her, but neither of them ever find out, because he's interrupted by another voice. A different kind of voice. Cold. Problem? Friedrich turns around first, so that Britt-Marie has time to see his eyes register the danger before she has time to see what he's worried about. He swallows.
No, she was...
Sammy is standing a few meters away with his hands in his pockets. He is 20 years old at most, but judging by the suffocating grip of his presence in the darkness, you might describe him as a spirit of violence. Britt-Marie wonders whether in a crossword this might be rendered as God of Aggression. Vertical, 15 letters. People have time to think of all sorts of things while they face up to what they imagine is their imminent violent death, and this happens to be the first thing that comes to Britt-Marie's mind. Friedrich stutters indecipherably. Sammy says nothing. Another young man is moving up behind him. He's taller. It's not at all difficult to guess why he's known as Psycho. His mouth is grinning, but it's not so much a grin as a display of teeth. Britt-Marie has heard tell of this sort of thing on the natural history programs Kent used to watch when there was no football on the TV. Human beings are the only animals that smile as a gesture of peace, whereas other animals show their teeth as a threat. This is perfectly understandable now. She can see the animal inside the human being. Psycho's smile grows wider. Sammy doesn't take his hands out of his pockets, doesn't even raise his voice. Don't you touch her, he says, nodding towards Britt-Marie, while keeping his gaze fixed on Friedrich. Friedrich totters back to his BMW. His self-confidence seems to grow with every step he takes towards it, as if the car is giving him superpowers. But he waits until he's standing right by the door before he hisses,
Retard, this old bloody place is completely retarded.
Psycho takes half a step forward. The BMW does a wheel spin in the mud and gravel and makes its escape in the rain. Britt-Marie has time to see the boy in the passenger seat, the one who's the same age as Ben and Vega and Omar, but taller and more grown up, wearing the tracksuit top on which it says, Hockey. He looks scared. Psycho looks at Britt-Marie, displays his teeth. Britt-Marie turns around and does her absolute best to walk briskly without breaking into a run, because in the natural history programs, they always say you shouldn't try to run away from wild animals. She hears Sammy calling out behind her, without anger or menace. In fact, almost softly.
See you around, coach.
She's 150 meters away when she finally has the courage to stop and catch her breath. When she turns around, the two men have gone back to a group of other young men on a patch of asphalt between some apartment blocks and a cluster of trees. The black car is there, with its engine running and the headlights on. The young men are moving about in the beams of light. Sammy yells something and surges forward, kicking his right leg into the air. Then he punches his fists up and cheers loudly at the sky. It takes Britt-Marie a minute to understand what they're doing. They're playing football. Playing. The temperature drops below zero in the night. Rain turns to snow. Britt-Marie stands on the balcony watching all this happening. She finds herself spending an inordinate amount of time thinking about sushi and how you make it. She cleans the mattress, hangs up her coat. When she hears Bank coming back and closing the door downstairs, she paces around the room 3 times and thumps her feet as hard against the floor as she can, just to clarify that she's there. Then she sleeps the dreamless sleep of exhaustion because she couldn't even begin to say whose dreams she might have. The sun is already up when she wakes. She almost falls out of bed when she realizes. Waking up long after the late rising January sun. What will people think? Still half asleep, she's making her way to her clothes when she realizes why she's woken up. Someone is knocking on the door. The whole thing is terribly vexatious, actually waking up at an hour when people are actually quite entitled to knock on your door. She fixes her hair as quickly as she can, then stumbles down almost the entire length of the stairs, very nearly breaking her neck. It's the sort of thing that happens every few minutes, people falling downstairs and killing themselves. She just about manages to land on her 2 feet at the bottom, in the hall, and then sets about gathering her wits. After a certain amount of hesitation, she rushes into the kitchen, which is obviously as dirty as you can possibly imagine, and then looks in all the drawers until she finds an apron. She puts this on. "Ah," she says, with raised eyebrows when she opens the door. She adjusts her apron, as you do when you're interrupted by someone knocking at your door while you are busy with the washing up. Vega and Omar are standing there.
"What are you doing?" asks Vega.
"I'm busy,"
Britt Marie answers.
"Were you asleep?"
asks Omar.
"Certainly not,"
Britt Marie protests while adjusting both her hair and her apron.
"We heard you coming down the stairs," says Vega.
"That's not a crime, is it?"
"Cool it, will you? We only asked if you were asleep."
Britt Marie clasps her hands together.
"It's possible that I may have overslept. It's not something that happens often."
"Did you have something you had to get up for?"
asks Omar. Britt Marie doesn't have a convincing answer to that one. There's a silence for a few moments until Vega's patience runs out, and she gets to the point with a frustrated groan.
"We were wondering if you wanted to eat with us tonight."
Omar nods energetically.
"And then we're wondering if you want to be our new coach for our team."
Then Omar shrieks,
"Ouch!"
And Vega hisses,
"Idiot!"
and tries to kick him again on the shin, but this time he gets out of the way.
"We wanted to invite you for dinner so we could ask you to be our coach, sort of like when they offer a contract in proper football teams," says Vega, sourly.
"I'm not particularly taken with football," says Britt Marie as politely as she can, which quite possibly is not very politely at all.
"You don't need to do anything. All you have to do is sign a bloody form and come to our bloody training sessions," protests Vega. "There's this wicked knockout competition in town. The council is organising it, and any team can take part, but you have to have a coach."
"There has to be someone else in Borg you could give this assignment to," says Britt Marie and starts backing away into the hall.
"No one else has time," says Vega. "But we were thinking you don't have anything to do sort of thing," says Omar with a cheerful nod.
Britt Marie pauses and looks thoroughly offended, adjusts her apron. "I'll have you know, I have a great deal to do."
"Like what?"
"I have a list."
"But I mean, God, this will hardly take any time at all. You only have to be there when we're training in case one of the competition organisers comes by so they can see we have a sodding coach,"
Vega groans.
"We're training at 6 this evening, in the parking area, by the recreation centre," says Omar with a nod.
"But I don't know anything about football."
"Nor does Omar, but we still let him play with us," says Vega.
"You bloody what?"
Omar exclaims. Vega, apparently losing her patience, shakes her head at Britt Marie.
"Never bloody mind, then. We thought you had it in you to be decent about it. This is Borg, so it's not like there are so many other bloody adults to choose from. You're the only one."
Britt Marie has nothing to say to that. Vega starts going down the steps and makes an irritated gesture at Omar to come with her. Britt Marie stays in the doorway, keeping her hands clasped together while opening and closing her mouth repeatedly until, at long last, she calls out,
"I can't at 6 o'clock.
Vega turns around. Britt Marie stares at her apron.
"Civilized people have their dinner at 6. You can't actually play football in the middle of your dinner."
Vega shrugs, as if it doesn't make any difference.
"Okay. Come over to ours and have dinner at 6 then, and we'll train afterwards."
"We're having tacos,"
says Omar, nodding with great satisfaction.
"What's tacos?"
The children stare at her.
"Tacos,"
says Omar, as if the problem could only have been that she didn't hear him properly.
"I don't eat foreign food,"
says Britt Marie, even though what she really means is, "Kent doesn't eat foreign food." Vega shrugs her shoulders again.
"If you don't eat the tortillas, it's like having salad." "We live in one of the high-rises, block 2, second floor,"
says Omar, and points down the road. Of course, it's not there and then that Britt Marie becomes the coach of a football team. It's just the point at which someone tells her, That's what she's become. She closes the door, removes her apron, puts it back in the drawer, then cleans the kitchen because she doesn't know how not to. Then she goes upstairs and fetches her mobile. The girl at the unemployment office picks up after a single ring.
Do you know anything about football?
Is that Britt Marie? Asks the girl, although she should have learned by now.
I need to know how one trains a football team, Britt Marie informs her. Do you need a permit from the local authority for that type of thing?
No, or what I mean is, what do you mean? Says the girl. Britt Marie exhales, but does not sigh.
My dear, if, for example, you want to have your balcony glazed, you need a permit. I'm assuming the same thing applies to football teams. Surely they're not beyond the rule of law just because the players run about kicking things all over the place.
No, I assume their parents have to sign some letter to say they're allowed to play in the team, says the girl, dubiously.
Britt Marie makes a note of that on her list, nods soberly to herself and asks, So can I ask, what's the first thing you have to do at football practice?
I'd say, but I don't know. The first thing you do at training, is to take the register.
I beg your pardon?
You have a register. You tick off the people who are there, says the girl.
A list?
Yes.
Britt Marie is already hung up. She may not know a lot about football, but even the gods know that no one is more skilled at lists than Britt Marie.
Chapter 16. Dino opens the door. He laughs when he sees Britt Marie, who assumes she has pressed the wrong bell, but in fact it turns out Dino always has his dinner with Vega and Omar, and Dino isn't necessarily laughing at her. Apparently, in spite of her first impressions, that is how things are done in Borg. People seem to have their dinners at other people's homes just like that, and then go around laughing as if they hadn't a care in the world. Omar comes running into the hall and points at Britt Marie.
Take off your shoes. Sammy gets really pissed off otherwise because he just mopped the floor.
I do not get pissed off,
comes a voice from the kitchen, sounding fairly pissed off.
He's always in a foul mood when it's our cleaning day, explains Omar to Britt Marie.
Maybe I wouldn't be in a foul one if we had a fucking cleaning day, but it's always me who has a fucking cleaning day in this place every day,
yells Sammy from the kitchen. Omar nods meaningfully at Britt Marie.
You see, pissed off.
Vega turns up in the doorway with a slumped upper body posture, waving an invisible bottle of spirits in imitation of somebody.
You know, Britt Marie, Sammy, he has... What's it called? Citrus fruit up the anus, huh?
Dino and Omar laugh until they are hyperventilating. Britt Marie responds with a brisk series of polite nods because this is as close as she gets to laughing out loud. She removes her shoes, goes into the kitchen, and nods cautiously at Sammy. He points at a chair.
The food is ready,
he says, and removes his apron, before immediately roaring towards the hall.
Grubs up!
Britt Marie checks her watch. It's exactly 6 o'clock.
Are we waiting for your parents? She asks, considerately.
They're not here,
says Sammy, and starts putting coasters on the table.
I suppose they're delayed coming home from work,
Britt Marie says pleasantly.
Mum drives a truck. Abroad. She's not home much,
says Sammy curtly, putting glasses and bowls on the coasters.
And your father?
He cleared off.
Cleared off?
That's right, when I was small. Omar and Vega were just born. I guess he couldn't take it, so we don't talk about him in this home. Mum took care of us. The food's ready now, so come here before I fucking beat the hell out of you.
Vega, Omar, and Dino saunter into the kitchen and start devouring their food, hardly stopping to chew it. It might as well have been liquidized and served up with straws.
But... Who takes care of you now, then, when your mother's not here?
Asks Britt Marie.
We take care of us, says Sammy, offended.
She doesn't know exactly what common conversational practice is after that, so she gets out the carton of cigarettes with the foreign letters on it.
Of course, I
usually bring flowers when I'm invited for dinner, but there's no florist in Borg. I've noticed you like cigarettes. I suppose cigarettes must be like flowers for someone who likes cigarettes, she explains, as if to defend herself. Sammy takes the carton of cigarettes. He looks almost emotional. Britt Marie sits in a spare seat and clears her throat. You're not afraid of cancer, I suppose.
There are worse things to be afraid of, says Sammy with a smile.
Ha, says Britt Marie and picks up something from her plate that she has to assume is a taco. Omar and Vega start talking at the same time, mostly about football, as far as Britt Marie can make out. Dino says almost nothing, but he laughs the whole time. Britt Marie doesn't understand what he's laughing at. He and Omar don't even need to say anything before they burst out laughing. All they have to do is look at one another. Children are unfathomable that way. Sammy points at Omar with his fork.
How many times do I have to tell you, Omar, take your fucking elbows off the fucking table?
Omar rolls his eyes, removes his elbows.
I don't get why you can't have your elbows on the table. What difference does it make?
Britt Marie observes him intensely.
It makes a difference, Omar, because we're not animals, she explains.
Sammy looks at Britt Marie appreciatively. Omar looks at them both with puzzlement.
Animals don't have elbows, he objects.
Eat your fucking food, says Sammy. When Omar and Dino are done, they stand up and run into another room, still laughing. Vega puts her plate on the draining board and looks as if she's expecting a diploma for effort. After that, she also runs off.
You could say thanks for the food, Sammy calls out after them, pissed off. Thanks for the food,
the children roar from an indefinable part of the flat. Sammy stands up and clatters demonstratively with the plates in the sink. Then he looks at Britt Marie.
Right. So you didn't like the food, then?
Excuse me, says Britt Marie. Sammy shakes his head, says something to himself punctuated by several fucking references, then snatches up the carton of cigarettes and disappears onto the balcony. Britt Marie stays in the kitchen on her own, eats what she is almost sure must be tacos. They taste less odd than she expected. She stands up, puts what's left of the food into the fridge, washes up and dries the plates and cutlery and opens the cutlery drawer. Leans over it, catches her breath. Forks, knives, spoons. In the right order. Sammy is standing on the balcony smoking when she comes out. Very nice dinner, Sammy. Thanks for that, she says, one hand firmly clasped in the other. He nods.
Sometimes it's nice if someone says it tastes good without your having to ask every time, you get what I mean.
Yes, she says, because she does get it. Then she feels that it would be in order to say something polite, so she says, You have a very nice cutlery drawer. He looks at her for a long time and then grins.
You're okay, coach.
Ha! Ha! You're also okay, Sammy. He drives them all to their practice session in his black car. Vega argues loudly with him all the way, which in Borg is not very far. Britt Marie doesn't understand what the argument is about, but it seems to have something to do with that psycho fellow, something about money. When they stop, Britt Marie has a sense that something ought to be done to change the subject, because this psycho makes her nervous in much the same way as too much talk about poisonous spiders. So she says, Do you also have a team, Sammy? You and those boys you were playing with the other night?
No, we don't have a team, says Sammy,
and looks as if it was a bit of a strange question. So why do you play football, then? Asks Britt Marie, puzzled.
What do you mean, why? Asks Sammy, just as puzzled.
Neither of them are able to come up with a good answer. The car stops. Vega, Omar, and Dino jump out. Britt Marie checks the contents of her bag to make sure she hasn't forgotten anything.
You ready, Britt Marie?
Asks Vega, as if she's already bored. Britt Marie nods with a good deal of concentration and points at her bag.
Yes, yes, obviously I'm ready. I should like to tell you that I have made a list.
Sammy parks the car with the engine running so that the headlights illuminate the parking area.
The children put out 4 fizzy drink cans as goalposts. Fizzy drink cans are magical in this way. They can transform parking areas into football pitches by their mere existence. Britt Marie holds up her list.
Vega?
She asks, loud and clear, while the children run about, kicking the ball with varying degrees of success.
What?
Says Vega, who's standing right in front of her.
Is that a yes? What are you talking about?
Britt Marie taps her pen against the list with extreme patience. My dear, I am reading the register. What one does is one reads out the names and then each respective person says, yes, it's common practice. Vega squints, disapprovingly.
You can see I'm standing here.
Britt Marie nods considerately.
My dear, if we could just tick people off in any old way, there wouldn't be any point doing the register, you have to understand. Never mind about your bloody register, let's just play,
Vega says, and kicks the ball.
Vega. Yes, Jesus!
Britt Marie nods intently and ticks Vega's name off on the list. Once she's done the same with the other children, she distributes handwritten notes to them with a short, very formal message, followed by 2 neat lines at the bottom, where it is written, parental signature. Britt Marie is very proud of the notes. She has written them in ink. Anyone who knows Britt Marie understands what an outstanding achievement it is for Britt Marie to control her compulsion never to write anything in ink. People really do change when they travel.
Do both parents have to sign?
Asks Pirate, who has arranged his hair so neatly that it really pains Britt Marie when in the next second a ball strikes his head.
Sorry, I was aiming at Vega,
yells Omar. Vega and Omar end up having a fight. The other children fling themselves into the chaos. Britt Marie walks around in circles trying to figure out how to give Vega and Omar their notes among all the flying fists, but in the end she gives up and walks determinedly across the parking area and hands their slips to Sammy instead. He's sitting on the bonnet of the black car, drinking one of the goalposts. Britt Marie brushes dust off every part of herself. Football is certainly not very hygienic.
You need help?
Asks Sammy. I'm not familiar with what a football coach is supposed to do when the players fight like wild dogs, Britt Marie admits.
You let them run, you know, idiot,
grins Sammy. I'm certainly not an idiot, protests Britt Marie.
No, it's an exercise. It's called idiot.
I'll show you. He slides off the bonnet and walks around the car. Britt Marie follows him, clasps one hand in the other and asks, not at all accusingly, might I trouble you for an answer as to why you don't train these children yourself if you know so much about this football thing? Sammy gets 6 soft drink cans out of the boot, hands one of them to Britt Marie.
I don't have time, he says.
Maybe you would if you didn't spend such an inordinate amount of time buying soft drinks, Britt Marie notes. Sammy laughs again.
Come on, coach. You do get that the council wouldn't let someone with my criminal record coach a youth team, he says, as if it's hardly worth mentioning.
Britt Marie keeps an extra firm grip on her handbag after that. Not because she judges people, obviously, but because there's a pretty strong wind in Borg tonight. No other reason. Idiot, the way it's done in Borg, is an exercise based on 6 soft drink cans being positioned at intervals of a couple of meters. The children stand by the fence between the recreation centre and the pizzeria. Then they run as fast as they can to the first soft drink can and as fast as they can back to the fence. Then as fast as they can to the second soft drink can, a little further away, and then back as fast as they can. And then to the third soft drink can, and so on.
For how long are they supposed to do that?
Asks Britt Marie.
As long as you like,
says Sammy.
For goodness sake, I can't make them do that.
Britt Marie objects.
You're the coach now. If they don't do what you tell them, they can't play in the competition.
It sounds quite deranged, in Britt Marie's opinion, but Sammy doesn't go into more detailed explanations because his telephone starts ringing.
What did you say the exercise was called?
Asks Britt Marie.
Idiot,
says Sammy, and then answers,
yeah,
into his telephone, as people do, who have no use for either exclamation marks or question marks. Britt Marie mulls this over at length until at long last she manages to say,
that's a good name for both the exercise and the person who came up with it.
By now, Sammy has started walking back to his car with the telephone pressed to his ear so he can't hear her. No one can. But this doesn't actually concern Britt-Marie so much. The children run between the soft drink cans, and Britt-Marie stands there beside them with a sort of happy fizziness in her whole body, repeating, "A good name for the exercise and the person who came up with it," very, very quietly to herself, over and over again. It's the first time, for as long as she can remember, that she has intentionally made a joke. Chapter 17. In the children's defence, they didn't do it on purpose. Or rather, it was obviously done on purpose, but none of them believed Toad would actually hit the mark, so to speak. They never hit anything they aim at, especially not Toad, who's the youngest and worst player in an already dismal team. It so happens that Bank, in an even blacker mood than usual, comes walking across the parking area with her white dog in the middle of a training session. Omar sees her go into the pizzeria or the corner shop or car workshop or whatever it is, and after a while come out again with one bag that seems to contain chocolate and another that seems to contain beer. Omar elbows Toad in the side and says,
"You think she has superpowers?"
Toad answers with a sound made by children whose mouths are full of goalpost. Omar gestures in an explanatory way to Britt-Marie, as if Britt-Marie might be more receptive to his line of reasoning, which must be reckoned as fairly exaggerated optimism.
"You know, what the hell? In films, blind types get superpowers, like Daredevil."
"I'm not familiar with Daredevil," explains Britt-Marie, with as much amicability as she can drum up, considering how enormously stupid this conversation is. Bank moves across the parking area with her stick in her hand, next to and slightly behind the white dog. Omar points at her exultantly.
"Daredevil is a superhero, except blind. So he has super senses. Instead, you think she does? Could she sort of sense it if you shot a football at her head, even though she couldn't see it?"
"She is not blind, she merely has impaired vision," says Britt-Marie. Omar, who has long since stopped listening to Britt-Marie, turns around and says,
"Do it, Toad."
Toad, who happens to have the ball at that moment, doesn't seem to think it's a very good idea. But then Omar utters those golden words that have the magical power to obliterate every child's self-restraint anywhere in the world. "You don't have the guts to do it." In fairness to Toad, he obviously never thought he'd hit her. They're all quite surprised that he does. Most surprised of all, obviously, is Bank.
"What the bloody!"
she roars. The children stand still at first, their mouths agape, like you do. Then Omar starts tittering. Then Vega follows suit. Bank storms towards them, incandescent, her stick cleaving the air.
"Was that funny, brats?"
Britt-Marie clears her throat and almost holds out her arms. "Please, Bank, he didn't mean to.
He obviously wasn't aiming at you. He obviously wasn't. It was obviously an accident." "Accident, accident, yeah,"
howls Bank, and it's a little unclear what she means by this.
"What do you mean? Not on purpose. He was aiming, wasn't he?"
yells Omar confidently, while at the same time moving out of cleaving range behind Britt-Marie.
"Did you really?"
Britt-Marie asks Toad in astonishment.
"Who did this?"
yells Bank, her entire face throbbing like a single thick vein emerging from her throat. Toad, paralysed, nods and backs away. Britt-Marie enthusiastically clasps one hand in the other and doesn't quite know what to do with herself.
"But it's absolutely marvellous," she manages to blurt out.
"What are you saying, you old bat?"
howls Bank. At this stage, everything that's reasonable inside Britt-Marie insistently tries to curb her enthusiasm, but clearly it doesn't have much success, because Britt-Marie leans in and whispers chirpily,
"They never hit anything they aim at, you see. This is really an excellent sign of progress."
Bank stares at Britt-Marie. At least, she seems to be staring. It's difficult to know for sure with those sunglasses. Britt-Marie gulps hesitantly.
"It's obviously not marvellous that he hit you. That is obviously not what I mean, but it is excellent that he hit anything at all."
Bank leaves the parking area in a hailstorm of the ugliest and most colourful words Britt-Marie has ever heard. Britt-Marie actually didn't even know it was possible to combine words for genitalia with words describing other parts of the body in that way. You don't even come across that level of verbal innovation in crosswords. A thoughtful silence envelops the parking area. Obviously, it's the voice of somebody that breaks it.
Like I said about that one, lemon up the ass.
She's sitting in the pizzeria doorway, grinning in the direction of bank. Britt-Marie brushes her skirt down.
I wouldn't want to suggest that you're wrong, I certainly wouldn't, but I do really think that on this occasion Bank's problem was not a lemon in the arse, but a football in the head.
They all laugh. Britt-Marie doesn't get angry about it. It's a new feeling for her. The boy with the tracksuit jacket with hockey written on it walks out of the pizzeria with a pizza box in his hands. He fails to hide his interest in the football training, realizes his mistake, and tries to quickly get moving. But Vega has already seen him.
"What are you doing here?" she calls out.
"Buying pizza," says the boy in the tracksuit, repentantly.
"Don't you have pizza in town or what?"
The boy looks down at his pizza box.
"I like the pizza here."
Vega clenches her fists but doesn't say anything else. The boy squeezes past somebody in the doorway and runs out towards the road. The BMW is parked 100 meters down the road with its engine running. Somebody turns to Vega with a grimace.
"He's not his dad. Dad can be pig. Kid could be good. You should know, if anyone."
Vega looks as if the words have wounded her. She turns around and kicks the ball so hard that it flies over the fence into the darkness. Somebody rolls a few meters towards Britt-Marie, nods at the pizzeria.
"Come, have something for you."
By this stage, Toad has drunk all the goalposts, and Vega kicks off a noisy dispute with Sammy, of which Britt-Marie can only distinguish something about psycho and owes money, by which she comes to the conclusion that the training session is over. She's unsure whether she should be doing anything in particular, such as blowing a whistle or similar, but she chooses not to, mainly because she doesn't have a whistle. Inside the pizzeria, somebody slides a fistful of money and a piece of paper across the counter.
"Here, this change, and this receipt, huh?"
She gestures towards the bottom of the door where Britt-Marie pushed the money through last night.
"Next time you can, what's it called? Come in!" she grins.
When Britt-Marie doesn't seem to know what to say, she adds,
"You left too much money for cigarettes, Britt-Marie. You are, what's it called? Either your maths is crap, or you're very generous, huh? I think Britt-Marie is generous, huh? Not like that Friedrich, for example, is so mean he yells every time he takes a shit."
She nods cheerfully. Britt-Marie mumbles, "Ha," repeatedly, neatly folds the receipt and puts it in her handbag. Takes the change and puts it in the vase for tips. Somebody rolls half a turn forward, then half a turn back.
"It looked nice, you know, looked nice when you cleaned her."
"Thanks," she says.
"It was not my intention to hide your belongings so you could not find them," says Britt-Marie, directing her voice into her handbag. Somebody scratches her chin.
"The cutlery, eh? Fork, knife, spoon, that order, I can, what's it called, get used to it."
Britt-Marie sucks in her cheeks, goes to the door. She has reached the threshold when she stops and summons her strength and says,
"I should just like to inform you that there's no urgency at the moment to have my car repaired."
Somebody looks out of the door at the children and their football pitch. She nods. Britt-Marie also nods. It's the first time for as long as Britt-Marie can remember that she has had a friend. The children take off their dirty jerseys and drop them off in the recreation centre, without Britt-Marie even having offered to wash them. There's no one left in the parking area by the time she's washed and tumble-dried the jerseys and put them in a neat pile, ready for tomorrow's training. Borg is empty, except for a lone silhouette by the bus stop on the road. Britt-Marie didn't even know there was a bus stop there until she saw someone waiting by the streetlight. She doesn't recognize Pirate until she's just a few meters away. His red hair is tangled and muddy, and he stands motionless as if trying to ignore that she's there. Her common sense tries to make her walk away, but instead she says, I was under the impression that you lived in Bourg. He keeps a firm grip on the note that Britt Marie handed out at the start of the training session.
It says here that you have to have both your parents' signatures, so I have to go and ask my father to sign it.
Britt Marie nods. Huh. Have a good evening, then, she says, and starts walking towards the darkness.
You want to come with me? He calls out after her.
She turns around, as if he's out of his mind. The paper in his hands is stained with sweat.
I think it would feel better for me if you were there, he manages to say.
It's obviously wholly ludicrous. Britt Marie is scrupulous about telling him that throughout the whole bus journey, which takes almost an hour, and ends abruptly in front of an enormous white building. Britt Marie is holding onto her handbag so tightly that she gets cramp in her fingers. She is, in spite of everything, a civilized person with a normal life to get on with. Civilized people with normal lives are actually not in the habit of visiting prisons. Chapter 18
Bloody gangsters, Kent always used to call them, the people who were responsible for things such as street violence, extortionate taxes, pickpocketing, graffiti in public toilets, and hotels where all the deck chairs were occupied when Kent came down to the pool. All things of this kind were caused by gangsters. It was an effective system, always having people there to blame for everything without ever having to define who they really were.
Britt Marie never found out what he really wanted, what would have satisfied him. Would a lot of money have been enough, or was every last penny required? One time when David and Panilla were teenagers, they gave him a coffee mug with a message on it. He who dies with the most toys wins. They said it was ironic, but Kent seemed to take it as a challenge. He always had a plan. There was always a bloody big deal just around the corner. His company was just about to strike bigger and bigger deals in Germany. The flat they inherited from Britt Marie's parents could finally be converted to a freehold so they could sell it for more money. Just a few more months. Just a few years. They got married because Kent's accountant said it made sense from a tax planning perspective. Britt Marie never had a plan. She hoped it would be enough if you were faithful and in love. Until the day came when it wasn't enough. Bloody gangsters, Kent would have said if he'd been sitting with Britt Marie this evening, in the little waiting room in the prison.
Put the criminals on a deserted island with a pistol each, and they'll clean up the sorry mess themselves.
Britt Marie never liked him talking like that, but she never said anything. Now, when she thinks about it, she has difficulties remembering the last time she said anything at all, until one day she left him without a word. Because of this, it always feels as if the whole thing was her fault. She wonders what he's doing now. If he feels well and wears clean shirts, if he takes his medicine, if he looks for things in kitchen drawers and yells out her name before he remembers that she's no longer there. She wonders if he is with her, the young and beautiful woman, and if she likes pizza. Britt Marie wonders what he would say if he knew she was sitting in a waiting room in a prison full of gangsters. If he'd be worried, if he'd tell a joke at her expense. If he'd touch her and whisper that everything would be all right, like he used to do in the days after she had buried her mother. They were very different people in those days. Britt Marie doesn't know if it was Kent or herself who changed first, or how much of it was her fault. She was ready to say everything, if she could only have her life back. Pirate sits next to her, holding her hand, and Britt Marie clutches his very hard in return.
You mustn't tell my mum we were here, he whispers.
Where is she?
At the hospital.
Was she in an accident?
No, she works there, says Pirate, before adding as if explaining a law of nature. All the mums in Bourg work at the hospital.
Britt Marie doesn't know what to say to that.
Why do they call you Pirate? She asks instead. Because my father hid the treasure.
As soon as she hears this, she decides she'll never call him Pirate again. A thick metal door opens, and Sven stands in the doorway, sweaty and red-nosed, with his police cap in his hands.
"Is Mum livid again?" says Ben at once, with a sigh.
Sven slowly shakes his head, puts his hand on the boy's shoulder, meets Britt Marie's eyes.
"Ben's mother is on the night shift. She called me as soon as they call from here. I came as quick as I could."
Britt Marie would like to hug him, but she's a sensible person. The guards won't let Ben see his father because it isn't visiting hours, but after much persuasion, Sven manages to get them to agree to take the paper into the prison. They come back with a signature. Next to the signature, his father has written, "Love you." Ben holds the paper so hard on their way back that it's illegible by the time they get to Borg. Neither he, Britt Marie, nor Sven utter a single word. There's not much you can say to a teenager who has to ask strangers in uniform for permission to see his father. But when they drop Ben off outside his house and his mother comes out, Britt Marie feels it's appropriate to say something encouraging, so she makes an attempt with,
"It was very clean, Ben, I have to say. I've always imagined prisons to be dirty places, but this one certainly seemed very hygienic. That is something to be pleased about, at least."
Ben folds the paper with his father's signature without meeting her eyes and then hands it to her. Sven quickly says,
"You should keep that, Ben."
Ben nods and smiles and holds the paper even more tightly.
"Is there training tomorrow?" he murmurs.
Britt Marie fumbles for her list in her bag, but Sven calmly assures him,
"Of course there's training tomorrow, Ben. Usual time."
Ben peers at Britt Marie. She tries to nod affirmatively. Ben starts up the path, then turns, smiles faintly and waves. They wait until he's buried his face in his mother's arms. Sven waves, but she doesn't see, just presses her face into her boy's hair and whispers something. Sven drives slowly through Borg, clears his throat uncomfortably, as you do when you have a bad conscience.
"They haven't had such an easy time, Ben and her. She's working triple shifts so they can keep the house. He's a good boy, and his dad wasn't a bad man. Well, sure, I know what he did was wrong. Tax evasion is a crime, but he was desperate. Financial crises can make people desperate, and desperation makes people foolish."
He goes silent. Britt Marie doesn't say anything about the financial crisis being over. For various reasons, it doesn't strike her as appropriate on this particular occasion. Sven has cleaned up the police car. "All the pizza boxes have been removed from the floor," she notes. They drive past the patch of asphalt, where Sammy and Psycho are playing football again this evening with their friends.
"Ben's father is not like them. I just want you to understand that he isn't a criminal. Not in the same way as those boys," explains Sven.
"Sammy is not like those boys either," protests Britt Marie, and the words slip out of her quickly. "He's no gangster. He has a spectacularly well-organized cutlery drawer."
Sven's laughter comes abruptly, deep and rolling like a lit fire to warm your hands.
"No, no, there's nothing wrong with Sammy. He just keeps bad company.
Vega seems to be of the opinion that he owes people money."
"Not Sammy, but Psycho does. Psycho always owes people money," says Sven,
and his laughter fades, spills onto the floor and disappears. The police car slows down. The boys playing football see it, but they hardly react. There's a certain swagger about their disregard for the police. Sven narrows his eyes.
"Sammy didn't have an easy time growing up either. More disasters of it, that family, than you'd consider fair by anyone's reckoning, if you ask me. He's both mother and father, as well as older brother to Vega and Omar, and that's not a responsibility anyone should put on the shoulders of a kid who hasn't even turned 20.
Possibly Britt Marie wants to ask what this means, the bit about both mother and father, but she manages not to, so he continues.
"Psycho is his best friend and has been since they were big enough to kick that ball around. Sammy could have been a really good player. Everyone saw his talent, but he was too busy surviving, perhaps."
"What does that mean?" asks Britt Marie, slightly wounded by the way Sven says it, as if she should understand without an explanation.
Sven holds up his palm apologetically.
"Sorry, I was thinking out loud.
How should I explain it? Sammy, Vega, and Omar's mother did all she could, but their father, he
he was not a good man, Britt Marie. When he came home and had his anger attacks, people heard him all over Borg, and Sammy was hardly old enough to go to school back then, but he took his younger sibling's hands and ran for it. Psycho met them outside their door every time. Psycho carried Omar on his back, and Sammy carried Vega, and then they ran into the forest until their dad fell into a drunken stupor. Night after night, until their dad just cleared out one day. And then that thing happened with their mother. He falls silent, as you do when you realize once again that you're thinking out loud. He doesn't try to hide that he's hiding something, but Britt Marie doesn't stick her nose in. Sven smooths the back of his hand over his eyebrows. Psycho grew into a properly dangerous lunatic. Sammy knows that, but Sammy's not the sort of person to turn his back on someone who once carried his younger siblings on his back. Maybe in a place like Borg you don't have the luxury of being able to choose your best friend. The police car once again starts rolling slowly down the road. The boys' football match continues. Psycho scores, roars something into the night and runs around the pitch with his arms extended as if he was an aircraft. Sammy laughs so much that he keels over, hands on his knees. They look happy. Britt Marie doesn't know what to say or what to believe. She has never met a gangster with a correctly organized cutlery drawer. Sven's gaze loses itself in some place where the headlights end and darkness begins. We do what we can in Borg, we always have done. But there's a fire burning in those boys, and sooner or later it will consume everyone around them. Or themselves.
That was nicely put, says Britt Marie. He smiles bashfully. She looks down into her handbag. Then she dismays herself by going further. Do you have any children yourself?
He shakes his head, looks out of the window as you do if you don't have any children, yet in spite of all have a whole village full of children. I was married, but she never liked Borg. She said it was a place where you came to die, not live.
He tries to smile. Britt Marie wishes she'd brought the bamboo screen along. He bites his lip. When they should turn off by Banks' house, he seems to hesitate, then summons his courage and says,
If it's not inconvenient to you, I'd like to show you something.
She doesn't protest. He smiles in a way you'd hardly notice. She smiles in a way no one could ever notice. He drives the police car through Borg and out the other side. Turns off down a gravel track. It apparently goes on forever, but when they finally stop, it suddenly seems inconceivable that they were just in a built-up area. The car is surrounded by trees, and the silence is of a sort that only exists where there are no people.
It's probably ridiculous, of course, but this is my favourite place on Earth.
Mumbles Sven. He blushes, looks like he wants to turn the car around and drive away fast and never mention it again. But Britt Marie opens her door and gets out. They are standing on a rock over a lake held tight by trees on all sides. Britt Marie peers down over the edge until she feels a queasiness in her stomach. The sky is clear and bright with stars. Sven opens his door and comes up behind her and clears his throat.
It's silly, but I wanted you to see that Borg can be beautiful as well, he whispers.
Britt Marie closes her eyes. She feels the wind in her hair.
Thank you, she whispers back.
They don't speak on the way back. He gets out of the car outside Banks' house, runs around and opens Britt Marie's door. Then he opens the door of the back seat and fumbles with something, coming back with a well-thumbed plastic folder.
It's just something, he manages to say.
It's a drawing of the recreation centre and the pizzeria, and in between the children playing football. Britt Marie in the middle of the picture, everything done in pencil. Britt Marie holds on to it a little too hard, and Sven removes his police cap a little too suddenly.
Well, it's probably silly, of course it is, but I was thinking there's a restaurant in town.
When Britt Marie doesn't answer at once, he adds briskly,
A proper restaurant, I mean, not like the pizzeria here in Borg, but a nice one with white tablecloths and cutlery.
It will be quite a long time before Britt Marie realizes
that he tries to hide his insecurity with jokes, rather than the other way around. But when she does not immediately seem to understand, he holds up his palm and apologizes.
Not that there's anything wrong with the pizzeria, of course not, but...
He's holding his police cap in both hands now, and looking like considerably younger men do when they want to ask considerably younger women something specific. There is so much inside Brit Marie that yearns to know what it is. But the sensible part, inside her, has already gone into the hall and closed the door.
Chapter 19 The Other Woman is what it's called, but Brit Marie always had difficulties viewing Kent's other woman as that, maybe because she herself knew how it felt to be that woman. Admittedly, Kent had already divorced when he came back to the house that day, a lifetime earlier, after Brit Marie had buried her mother. But his children never saw it that way. Children never see it that way. As far as David and Pernilla were concerned, Brit Marie was the other woman, regardless of how many fairy tales she read them and how many dinners she cooked. And maybe Kent also regarded her as such. And despite the number of shirts she'd washed, maybe Brit Marie never quite felt like the primary woman herself. She sits on the balcony, watching the morning dawdling over Borg, as mornings in Borg have a habit of doing in January. Daylight comes apparently without any need for the sun to rise. She is still holding Sven's drawing. He is not an especially good drawer, far from it, and if she'd been more critical by nature, she might have had reservations about what the blurred contours and irregular silhouettes were saying about the way he saw her. But at least he saw her. It's difficult to steel oneself against that. She fetches her mobile and calls the girl at the unemployment office. The girl's voice answers very gaily, so Brit Marie understands it has to be the telephone answering machine. Obviously, she intends to hang up, because she doesn't find it appropriate leaving messages on answering machines unless you're calling from a hospital or selling narcotics. But for some reason or other, she doesn't hang up. Instead, she sits in silence after the peep and declares at last, "This is Brit Marie. One of the children in the football team hit something he was aiming for today. I felt you might be interested to hear that." She feels silly when she hangs up. Obviously, the girl won't be interested in that. Kent would have laughed at her if he was here. Bank is sitting in the kitchen having soup when Brit Marie comes down the stairs. The dog is sitting next to the table, waiting. Brit Marie stops in the hall and looks at the soup plate. She wonders how the soup was cooked, because she sees no saucepan and the kitchen doesn't have a microwave. Bank is slurping.
"Did you have something to say, or is it just that you never saw a blind person having soup before?" she asks, without lifting her head.
"I was under the impression you had impaired vision."
Bank slurps loudly by way of an answer. Brit Marie presses the palms of her hands against her skirt.
"You like football, I understand," she says, nodding at the photographs on the walls.
"No," says Bank.
Brit Marie clasps her hands together over her stomach and looks at the rows of photographs on the wall, each one of them of Bank and her father, and at least one football.
"I've become a sort of coach for a team."
"I heard."
She starts slurping again, doesn't raise her head. Brit Marie brushes some specks of dust from various objects in the hall.
"At any rate, I noticed all the photographs, so I felt it was appropriate under the circumstances, bearing in mind your obvious experience of football, that I ask you for a piece of advice."
"Piece of advice about what?"
"About football."
She doesn't know if Bank rolls her eyes, but it certainly feels as if she does. The dog goes into the living room. Bank walks behind, running her stick along the walls.
"Where are these photos you're talking about?" she asks.
"Higher up."
Bank's stick taps the glass of one of the framed photos in which a younger version of herself is standing, wearing a jersey so badly stained that not even bicarbonate of soda would have helped. Bank leans towards the photo until her nose is almost touching the glass. Then she moves around the room and taps systematically at all the photos, as if memorizing where they are.
Britt-Marie stands in the hall and waits for what she considers to be an appropriate length of time, until the whole thing stops being merely uncomfortable and starts getting downright odd. Then she puts on her coat and opens the door. Just before it closes, Bank grunts behind her.
You want some good advice? That team can't play. Nothing you do will make any difference.
Britt-Marie whispers, "Huh," and walks out. She locks herself into the laundry at the recreation centre, sits on one of the stools while her skirt, still muddied from the truck incident, spins around in the washing machine. Once she's got dressed and fixed her hair, she stands for a long time in the kitchen, observing the coffee percolator that was destroyed by flying stones. Britt-Marie decides to assemble an entire piece of IKEA furniture that day, and for some reason ends up doing so at the pizzeria. It takes the best part of 10 hours, because there are actually 3 items of furniture, 1 table and 2 chairs, intended for balconies. Britt-Marie pushes them as far as they'll go into a corner, puts out kitchen roll as a tablecloth, and then sits there on her own eating pizza that somebody has baked for her. It is a remarkable day in Britt-Marie's life, unique even among the consistently remarkable days she's had since arriving in Borg. Sven has his dinner at another table in the pizzeria. But they have their coffee together, without saying anything to one another. Just trying to get used to the presence of the other person, as you do when it's been a long time since anyone's presence had a physical effect on you. A long time since a person could be sensed without physically touching at all. Carl comes in to pick up a parcel, sits down at a table in the corner and has a cup of coffee beside the men with caps and beards. They continue to intentionally ignore Britt-Marie, as if this might make her disappear. Vega comes in with a football under her arm, as dirty as only a child can get in the short distance between her older brother's car and a pizzeria. Omar comes in behind her, and when he sees Britt-Marie's newly assembled balcony furniture, immediately tries to flog her some furniture polish. When Britt-Marie walks out to go to the training session, Sven stands up with his police cap in his hands, but he doesn't say anything, and she speeds up to make sure he doesn't have the opportunity. Ben's mother is standing outside the door. She's wearing her hospital clothes and holding something in her hands.
"Hello, Britt-Marie, we haven't met, but I'm Ben's mu—"
"I'm aware of who you are," says Britt-Marie guardedly, as if preparing to be spattered with mud again by a passing truck.
"I just wanted to say thank you for, well, for seeing Ben. Not many grown-ups do," says Ben's mother and holds out what she has in her hands.
It's a bottle of Vaxin. Britt-Marie is dumbstruck. Ben's mother clears her throat awkwardly.
"I hope it doesn't seem silly. Ben asked Omar what you liked, and Omar said you liked this. He gave us a special deal, so we, well, Ben and I, we wanted to say thanks for everything."
Britt-Marie holds the bottle as if she's afraid of dropping it. Ben's mother takes a step back, then stops and adds,
"We want you to know there's another Borg than the one with a couple of old blokes sitting in a pizzeria boozing all day. There are the rest of us as well, those of us who haven't given up."
With that, she turns around before Britt-Marie has a chance to respond, gets into a little car, and drives off. The training begins, and Britt-Marie calls the register and makes a note on her list, and the children do the idiot, because that's the next item on Britt-Marie's list after take register. The children hardly complain at all, the one exception being when Vega asks if they've practiced enough, and Britt-Marie says they have, and Vega immediately gets stirred up and yells something about how this team will never improve if their coach goes easy on them. Children are beyond understanding, this much is abundantly clear. So Britt-Marie writes in her list how they have to do the idiot more, and that's precisely what they do. After that, they gather in a ring around Britt-Marie and look like they expect her to say something. And Britt-Marie goes to Sammy, who's sitting on the bonnet of his black car, and asks him what sort of thing this might be.
"Ah, you know, they've been running and now they want to play. Give them a pep talk and just toss the ball to them."
"A pep talk?"
"Something encouraging," he clarifies.
Brit Marie thinks about it for a while, then turns to the children and says with all the encouragement she can muster,
"Try not to get too dirty."
Sammy laughs. The children look utterly perplexed and start a practice match. Toad, who's the goalkeeper at one end, lets in more goals than anyone else, 7 or 8, one after the other. Every time it happens, his face turns completely scarlet and he roars,
"Come on now, let's turn this thing around."
Sammy laughs about that every time. This makes Brit Marie nervous, so she asks, "Why is he behaving like that?"
"He has a dad who supports Liverpool," Sammy answers without elaboration.
He grabs 2 cans from the back of the car and gives one of them to Brit Marie.
"If you have a dad who supports Liverpool, you always fucking think you can turn anything around, you know, ever since that Champions League final."
Brit Marie sips her soft drink from the can and thinks that, by doing this, she is finally beyond all limits of honour and decency. So she decides she might as well say what she feels. "I don't want to be unpleasant in any way, Sammy, because you have a quite impeccable cutlery drawer, but by and large I find everything you say utterly mystifying." Sammy guffaws.
"You too, Brit Marie. You too."
Then he tells her about a football game, almost a decade ago, at a time when Vega and Omar were hardly out of their nappies, yet nonetheless sat there with him and Psycho in the pizzeria. Liverpool were up against Milan in the Champions League final. Brit Marie asks whether this is a competition, and Sammy answers that it's a cup. And Brit Marie asks what a cup is, and Sammy says it's a sort of competition, whereupon Brit Marie points out that he could just have said that from the start instead of giving himself airs and graces. Sammy gives a deep breath, which is not at all a sigh. Then he explains that Milan were in the lead by 3-0 at half-time, and no team in any final of any football competition for as long as Sammy can remember had ever been so exposed and outplayed as Liverpool in this match. But in the changing rooms, one of the players from the Liverpool team stood yelling like a madman at the others because he would not go along with a world where there were certain things that could not be turned around. In the second half, he headed in a goal to make it 3-1, then waved his arms like crazy and ran back down the pitch. When his team scored again to make it 3-2, he was on his way to heaven because he and all the others saw it now, saw that there was an avalanche in motion and no one could stop them from turning it around. Not with walls, moats and 10,000 wild horses would it be possible to hold them back. They equalised to make it 3-3, survived extra time, then won on penalties. You can't tell someone with a father who supports Liverpool that everything can't be turned around after that. He looks at Vega and Omar and smiles.
"Or an older brother, I suppose. It could be an older brother too."
Brit Marie sips her goalpost. "It sounds almost poetic, the way you describe it." Sammy grins.
"Football is poetry for me, you know. I was born in the summer of 1994, right in the middle of the World Cup."
Brit Marie doesn't have a clue what that's supposed to mean, but she doesn't ask, because she thinks there has to be some limit to the anecdotes, even if they happen to be poetic.
"Does Toad's dad come here to watch him play?" she asks. "He's standing right there," says Sammy, pointing at the pizzeria.
Carl stands in the doorway drinking coffee. He has a red cap on his head. Looks almost happy. It's a very remarkable day for Brit Marie. A remarkable game. Sven is waiting for her in the pizzeria at the end of the session. He offers her a lift home, but she insists that there's no need. Then he asks if he can drive her balcony furniture back instead, and at long last, she agrees to that. He's carried it out and loaded it, and almost got into the driver's seat, when she closes her eyes and summons all the energy she has in order to blurt out,
"I have dinner at 6.
"Sorry," says Sven, after his head has popped up on the other side of the police car. She digs her heels into the mud.
"It's not as if I have to have a white tablecloth on the table, but I want cutlery and I want us to eat at 6.
"Tomorrow,"
he says effervescently. She nods grimly and gets her list out. When the police car has disappeared down the road, Vega, Omar and Sammy
call out to her from the other side of the parking area. Sammy is grinning. Vega shoots the ball all the way across the ground.